If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome, welcome everyone from around the world. I'm Alan Miller, this is TNT Radio, and I'm really, really pleased to be joining you live today for the show. There's so much has happened this week around the world, but also, of course, in the United Kingdom. We have seen Nigel Farage have his bank accounts threatened to close, and also seven other bank accounts not allowing him to open up. So he's been saying he's been called a non-person, because if you can't have a bank account, how do you exist? And we know this has been going on with lots of people, us for them. We just had Molly Kingsley on the show, had a similar thing, and also with PayPal. We know that Toby Young, the Free Speech Union, and many of us across the board have had this. And we've just seen someone of the church recently have the same thing happen with Metro Bank because of his particular views on biological sex. And it's a very, very chilling moment where it looks like, to me, actually, campaigners and activists and others are targeting people like they did in the academy. Rather than discuss ideas and the merit and the virtue of your views in the public domain, the public arena. And let's be honest, the more that happens on many of these so-called cultural issues, these controversial issues, the more the public become aware of them and get engaged, the more people are like, hold on a minute, that's absolutely nonsense. And that's why it's so important to have public debate and discussion, because it's where the democratic kind of arena occurs, where the public, the people, get to have our voices, no matter if you've got a PhD or you left school at, you know, without any qualifications. The whole idea is that in the public arena, we all get a voice, we all get a vote. That often is limited these days because managerial technocrats don't even want to allow that, do they? We're seeing that with consultations. We just did a fantastic event in Bristol with lots of people challenging low traffic neighbourhoods, a clean air zone that's being imposed. We're often told that people who are campaigning against this are far right. And there we saw such a diverse community in Bristol. A big shout going out to everyone there. And what's inspiring is that people up and down the country are now challenging things. They're challenging the silencing of free speech. They're challenging these impositions and restrictions. They're challenging things like the ultra-low emission zone, ULEZ, which Mayor Sadiq Khan is trying to stampede and roll out across all of the areas in outer London. And now what we've seen, a coalition, which Together is part of, and many others, all the campaigners, many from various different political parties, leaders and independents have all signed up to this coalition to stop ULEZ Together. And that's very exciting. It's also, of course, the 75th anniversary of the NHS. And, you know, two world wars and a global recession, a depression, in fact, which ended up with many of the reforms that we saw and some really radical, innovative things that happened in Britain with Nye Bevan and others, with education, the Butler Education Act, and of course, the National Health Service. But 75 years on, what does that mean for everyone? And what is service really like? Apparently, the King's Fund have just done a piece of 9% of people are satisfied with the service. So while some tell us this has got to be treated like a religious icon, a deity, we know that the experience of many of us is very, very frustrating, along with social care. And in fact, it was a year ago to the day almost, it was actually at Living Freedom last year, that I found out about a very large Dr. Helena Goldberg, a campaigner for freedom for many years, a warrior, very heroic, had lost her fight. And much of it was to do with the delays to cancer treatment due to lockdowns and restrictions and impositions. And yes, in Britain, and we need, I think, ladies and gentlemen, a proper discussion. In Britain, we only need to look at Germany and other places in Europe where they have different models. You don't have to just say, well, it only has to be like America. America has some brilliant provision, but has some challenges as well. But that needs to be as well discussed, debated publicly, democratically. And I'm very excited because my next guest is someone who was not scared to put his head above the parapet, who was willing to risk his situation in his career during lockdowns and to have his voice heard. He's very vocal in a number of areas when it was very difficult to do so. We should remember that there was a rapid response unit by the government, the cabinet, and also a CDU, a disinformation unit that's still running, run by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. You can't make this up, ladies and gentlemen. Spy units as well as bank accounts being taken down. Cancelling. We've seen it with the Twitter files and the lockdown files. I didn't really want to release any more of them, but that's now coming out more and more. But many of us know this already. And Dr. Ahmed Malik was someone that's been very vocal. He's a surgeon who has at the same time been advocating for medical ethics. He's very, very clear on the need for freedom of speech. And he has very particular views on health, which we're going to talk about. He's also got a podcast that he's just launched. I must say his video skills are very good, slightly envious. You can learn that. So this is what happens when you're really bright. You can learn these things quickly, which you can find at Doc Malik Podcast. He's got loads of Twitter followers and others. And welcome to the show, Dr. Ahmed Malik. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm chuckling away at the introduction. Thank you so much.
Well, no, very it's great to have you here. And I suppose, well, it's all true. But what I would say is, just on this coming in on this thing on the 75th anniversary of the NHS, right? I mean, just if you would, usually I get people to say how they came into the whole experience of lockdown and their views. But what would be interesting to hear is just tell us your journey about becoming a surgeon and what your thoughts are about the were growing up or anything else about the NHS and the sort of provision in the UK. If you give us a bit of a background on you first on that, it'd be really, really good to set the context.
Can I ask something? How long have I got to talk?
We've got an hour, so we've got a couple of breaks and we've got time. So we're going to get right into the juicy stuff.
All right, let's crack into it. First of all, can I just say, I love your Instagram feed. We have a lot in common about ULEZ and the currency and social credit system and the direction of travel. And I like the fact you have a go at everybody, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. It's very important that we, you know, challenge everybody. Anyway, back to your question. So I was born in Scotland to immigrant parents, grew up in a very deprived part of Glasgow. Where I grew up, no one went to university. The average age, life expectancy of people was like, men was 40, 45, dying of either alcoholism or heroin addiction. My parents, typical Asian parents, wanted me to get out of that working class, deprived area and stress the importance of education and working hard. And they suggested I become a professional, not necessarily a doctor, just, you know, use my brain. They said, no one can take that away from you. So I studied like a crazy person. I actually wanted to be a pilot. My mom said that's just being a glorified bus driver. So, you know, I fell in love with the idea of becoming a surgeon. I love anatomy, biology. I love dissection in school. So, yeah, I went to med school, went through the medical school training and was just passionate about being a surgeon. And it's all exams and hard hours, long hours and studying. And yeah, I managed to climb through the ranks and became a surgeon, working in the NHS, believed in the NHS fundamentally was a fantastic thing, you know, free healthcare at the point of delivery to everybody, regardless of their background, regardless of who they were. It just seems like such a noble thing, something that we need to protect. But then the problem started. The more I became senior and responsible in delivering the healthcare rather than just learning, especially when I became a consultant and head of the department, I became more and more disillusioned. So the NHS isn't actually free. That's not true. We all pay taxes. We pay insurance basically for the NHS, and we pay quite a lot of money, every single one of us. It's, you know, the equivalent of an insurance premium. So it's not free. Yeah. Two, it is fundamentally very anti-democratic and very anti-individual doctor-patient relationship. It's very much about mass conformity and adhering to guidelines and protocols, which are essentially anti-individual. It's a blanket, one-size-fits-all kind of approach. It also is not starved of cash, as many people would think. It's actually a cash cow and very corrupt system rewarding people and private institutions, consultancy firms for beginners. It's also not public. Much of the NHS is actually private organizations delivering a service, and they slap a little NHS logo on top, and then it gives you the impression it's owned by the government and the people. It's not, being run by private companies, and they do it for profit. So much of the NHS is actually already privatized, and most people don't know it. And it's been stripped back so badly, and the policies that have been introduced are so failed and incompetent. I almost feel it's being done by design. Make a service so sick and poor and feeble, people will vote for an alternative. If Labour or Conservative ever said, oh, let's get rid of the NHS and bring in something else, do you know what? They'd be voted out. There'd be riots. But if you engineer it slowly over decades to fail, and in the meantime, privatize it, and then when the people say we've had enough, you introduce big mega corporations who will just strip mine the whole thing. Yeah, great. Job done. So I left the NHS in 2017, very disillusioned. I realized that if you were hardworking, innovative, you would get punished. You would not get rewarded. You just get more work dumped on you. If you're lazy, dragging your heels, did the bare minimum, you got rewarded. You got a job for life. Then you go along to meetings, and the more meetings you go to, the higher the positions you get, titles, and then you get rewarded with merit awards and, you know, excellence awards. And there's something called Clinical Excellence Award, which is hilarious because it's got nothing to do with your clinical practice and it's nothing to do with excellence. It's all about schmoozing and rubbing, you know, with the right company. So basically, you know, yeah, I got very disillusioned. You know, I was being told how to treat my patients. I was told they were not my patients. I was told they were the hospital's patients. So I fundamentally couldn't treat patients the way I would want to treat my family. I had to treat them like a number. I found that very stressful. I would argue if you're in the NHS, the only way to manage is to not care, because then you don't get stressed. But if you do care, you burn out. And that's why you see both. You see doctors and nurses leaving, burnt out, you know, stressed, sick, off sick, because they care. And those who don't really care or just learn to cope, they do the bare minimum. And that's where you lack that, you know, personal touch. Doctors, you know, have lost, I think, their way. They're scared to speak out. So take, for example, with the vaccine harms that are happening left, right, and center, the massive elephant in the room that just keeps growing and growing. All the doctors are, you know, blind to it. They're like, nope, we don't see anything. Can't be the vaccine. Nope, must be something else. And why? Two reasons. Because of a blind obedience to authority, or because they're too scared to speak up. And I've had doctors come up and say that to me. Say, yeah, I've seen this and it's definitely the vaccines. And I go, why don't you say anything? Oh God, no, I'm not saying anything. Why? Because when the NHS is your employer, the single biggest employer of doctors by far, one of the biggest employers in the world, actually. When most of your salary, if all of your salary is coming from this institution, and if you stray out of line, you're going to get pulled up, investigated, disciplined, and may lose your livelihood and your ability to pay your bills. Yeah, you know what? These doctors are staying quiet. They're looking away. They all know what's happening. So that's not good. And I think the future is independence. It's the same with media and law and everything. Everything's been captured or compromised. And the only people that you can rely on now are independent sources, independent journalists, independent doctors, independent lawyers, because, you know, our bills are not being paid by someone who we need to please. The only people we need to please are the people. If I don't do a good job, patients will walk away. I'm only as good as the last patient I treated. So I will have to treat every patient like my family. I give them time. I give them my sweat, blood, and whatever it takes to make them better. And there is no guaranteed income. I don't have a safety net. So I would argue, as a private independent doctor, I am going to be working much, much harder to make sure my patients do well and are happy. And sadly, what I'm seeing on an increasing level, I mean, it was bad 10 years ago, but it's almost every day now. Patients telling me no one is listening to them. Questions aren't being answered. No one's been given time. Appointments are constantly being canceled. Their concerns are being ignored. They're not being heard. And that's a sad state of affairs. Now, the funny thing is, people always say it's very difficult to fix the NHS. It's very difficult. Yeah, it depends. It depends if you're a corrupt person.
Well, can I just hold you there for one? Because you said a lot of things there. And I want to sort of do a deep dive on a couple of them that are really important.
Go.
And look at what then could be done or not. We're going to take a quick break. And when we're going to come back, we're going to take a deep dive on this. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Ahmed Malik. And this is TNT Radio. Join us just after this break.
You should hear what Greg Maybury is talking about.
An article this week that reported on a few sort of half-famous Hollywood denizens who apparently want to shut parents up and stop them having their say on transgender issues. And I was struck by, even by Hollywood standards, the hypocrisy, the double standards, sheer cowardice and the faux righteousness of this crowd. I mean, who on earth are they to be demanding that anybody be denied the right to voice their views about anything? And my question is, where were these folks during the fake pandemic and the rollout of the globally mandated clot shot that delivered more toxic side effects than you can poke a hypodermic at in a month of wet hospital Sundays? Mostly they were shilling for Criminal Big Pharma Incorporated, like the not-so-incredible Hulk, Arnold Schwarzenegger, or the smarmy Stephen Colbert, a man who I suspect has never passed a hallway mirror without stopping to admire the view.
The No-Fly Zone with Greg Maybury on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Radio works because of its ability to personalize to the listener.
What's exciting these days is that people are rediscovering it. You know, people are really rediscovering just how powerful radio is, how ubiquitous it is. It's in our cars, it's in our homes. There are so many new ways to access it. It's everywhere.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
My neighbor is so excited. He just filled up his gas tank for $28. The bad news is it was his lawnmower.
I got the high.
This sucks.
High gas prices blues.
Come on, man.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Ahmed Malik, and he's just done an explosive overview of his history in medicine and the NHS and issues that he sees within it and the need for independence. Let me just play devil's advocate for 1 second, if you would. You say that if you're independent, you're only accountable to your, let's call them customers or clients or whoever it may be. But there are lots of examples, aren't there, of people advising, let's say, in, let's just take cosmetic care for an example, but it could be anything. It could be dentistry, it could be heart surgery, it could be all sorts of things, that people can keep advising that that the public need these things and doing treatments. We've seen it for time immemorial, even though there are some, you know, for the most part, really diligent, hardworking people, and keep doing lots of different procedures. If you're charging privately, you can make a lot of money. We see it in cosmetic surgery. You can see it across the board. Why is it this idea that, you know, just because you are independent, and that the same can be saying for your own opinions, you might... you can have a myriad of different views out there, but why should anyone trust your particular opinions anymore as an independent who doesn't necessarily have time to fact check or to do source checking or any of the sort of diligence you would hope and expect that a standard in journalism would have? How can you get a guarantee that it's more trustworthy as an independent?
So let me answer that. So basically, great question. Look, in every walk of life, you've got good people, bad people. I mean, I always say it's so hard to find good people, whether it's a plumber, a car mechanic, you know, a dentist, whatever. And the reality is that's the system we work in where we have to do our own research. People have to learn to do their own groundwork. They shouldn't trust me. They shouldn't trust you. They shouldn't trust the government. They should trust their own gut instinct and their own intuition and do their own research and stop abdicating critical thinking to other people. That's number one. Two, fundamentally, you need to think about what kind of society do you want? Do you want society where the government is the nanny state and protects you and does everything for you and does the critical thinking for you and makes life all cozy and comfortable? Or do you want independence? And there will be some people who will be bad and some people will be good, but that's the world that you live in and you have to walk your own path. Now, I would argue if you go down that nanny state route, that's fundamentally communism. And just as much as they can provide the comfort and ease, they can also withdraw it from you. So fundamentally, if you are all about freedom, you do not want big government. You do not want big institutions. Now, moving back to one of the things you were talking about, the NHS, saving the NHS, you know, fundamentally, just look at what happened in the last 3 years with this so-called pandemic. And I think this is really important. And I want to ask you, Alan, do you think there was a pandemic?
Well, there's a lot of unknowns still, in my opinion, because I was going to talk to you about that, like doing proper autopsies, what people actually died of or with, still controversial, a proper discussion about people that were normally dying excess deaths over 5 years comparative to that particular period. Something was definitely happening, I think. And the specific definition of a pandemic is quite particular. And I think we had a major challenge. But can I just ask you, because you've asked me that question.
I want to add to that. So it's actually not that difficult. It's very simple. There was no pandemic. There was a slightly increased death rate. But if you look at even the initial data coming at the Princess Diamond cruise ship, which I'm sure you've heard of, fatality rate was no more than a bad flu season. John Ioannidis published a paper very early on in 2020 showing that clearly. Okay, you know about that. I know about that. So there was no pandemic. It was a bad flu season. Now, you just inferred that there was some deaths going on. Absolutely. What we really need to be looking into is what happened with midazolam, what happened in the care homes, what happened with remdesivir, what happened to normal medical practice, and instead of intubating everybody, why weren't people given antibiotics? What was going on in the care pathways? How much of these deaths were caused by iatrogenic harm, i.e. doctors and the pathways that we instigated? And how much of it was mislabeling of people who were just dying anyway? But if there was actually a novel... Let me just explain why I'm saying this. Because the government knew there was no pandemic. The government knew there was no pandemic. Now, they said to us, we need to save the NHS. Stop going to hospital. Yeah. Shut down all the waiting lists. Clap on a Thursday evening. Now, they knew there was no pandemic. They instigated measures that would kill off an already dying institution. Do you understand now what's going on?
I want to get into this with you. Let's get into this with you, because you said this at the start, and this is the really important thing. So what I think what you said was that what better way than to get rid of the NHS than to have slowly and gradually, consistently, have it diminished in its delivery and its efficiency, have people just give up on it and then offer it up to big corporations. And my question is about the role of intention with different people, stakeholders of different kinds. So you could say, well, Dr. Ahmed Malik was never interested in helping people at all. He was just one of those kids, you know, he bought a narrative, which is that it's better to get out of poverty. And he was lucky enough and worked hard enough to do it. But then, you know, like everyone else, he just got into his own narrative, his own thing. And, you know, he's saying what he thinks. And, you know, you can't really trust anyone to do anything. No one who works in the NHS, no policymakers, they're all colluding with this idea, with a big plan, which no one else is whistleblowing. Somehow some people are talking about, but no one's talking. Rather than saying, it looks like for many reasons that we could discuss, that the NHS has become very bloated, very ideological captured. It looks like there's a huge amount of consultants earning 2 to 3 times, even during COVID, than frontline staff workers. It looks like they're having to do all these policy deliveries like EDI and ESG. And yet, what does it mean for the actual public? And within that, there was a raging debate, right, in the past about how much should be there. Labour and Conservative used to battle over these things somewhat. That's gone away. And we've got a load of managerial technocrats. But there's a difference between how we've got here and saying that was a specific intention, I think, right? You're putting forward an argument. And then you're saying that because some people like Matt Hancock and others were pushing things like midazolam, and that everyone in the government and in the institutions is all part of this plan, I think is what you're saying, right? I'll just clarify if I'm wrong on this. And then the reason to do that is then they can sell it off to private. Well, why would you not? The public-private partnership that Tony Blair did many years ago, which already incorporated the private sector, as you've so brilliantly outlined in the start, that was already introduced. The market was introduced and it was fudged. We spend more public money on there than ever before, but the private sector's in there as consultants and others. And what makes anyone think that they would need to do that rather than just say, well, this is what we're doing. We're having a German-style, French-style mixed delivery. A lot of people already have private healthcare in Britain already. Why do you think it's that rather than just a consequence of all of these things that have happened?
Alan, you kind of lost me there.
Well, you're saying it's intended by, but who are the people that are intending and doing it?
Look, they've already. I only deal with what I can see and what I know, right? I'm not interested in who's doing it and whatever. Look, the fact is the NHS is bloated, significantly inefficient, and corrupt. Okay, there's no fact, there's no doubting that. The whole private partner initiative that Blair instigated, lovely Blair, Labour, working class, you know, couldn't have been more conservative in that sense. He basically privatized wholesale hospitals. What these hospitals, modern hospitals, were built on is debt, and it's not a mortgage. It's not that you're paying off and at the end of the 20, 30 years, the hospital will then own itself and it'll be owned by the government. No, it's after 20, 30 years, you're paying rent, and at the end of it, it's owned by the private corporations. There will be no assets. There will be no government assets, public assets. Now, what I'm going back to is the Matt Hancocks and the Boris Johnsons, whatever, and the Chris Whitties and the Valencies. They knew there was not a pandemic. So why did they stick a sharp stake into the heart of the NHS by instigating the lockdowns and the social distancing and the masking and the mandates? You know what happened with the mandates? How many nurses left? Now, you know, Do you believe in the COVID vaccine? Do you think it was a good thing? Do you think it was required?
I argued quite consistently from day one that, like the Princess Diamond that you've mentioned, that it was clear from the get-go, and I was in New York when I first saw it all happening, that the demographic and the people at risk was a very particular group, at least over 75-year-olds, high risk with high vulnerabilities or those with underlying liabilities. Now, most, and I agree with you, most people who were looking at it could see that and knew that, even if you didn't take on board what was coming out from China at the time, right, with stats and everything. It was very, very clear from early on. So it was also somewhat questioning. I think I started asking many more questions when we suddenly went from we're going to protect the vulnerable to everyone under 60, then 50, then for all of a sudden, everyone, we went from 15 million jabs to freedom to much more. One thing I want to say is I know very little about medicine and science, right? So it's very difficult when you say, and I think this is one of the problems of what happened, right? That look, much of the public, we used to say lay, you can get bamboozled by this stuff because you're like, I really don't understand it. And I'm, you know, and when you say it's the trust thing is important. Like, can you trust your doctor who do you trust?
And listen, you're answering too much like a politician. Look, just be very clear about this. Do you believe in these COVID vaccines or not? Yes or no?
Well, at this point, I think that it is very, very clear. They don't stop transmission. They don't stop people from getting it. It's ridiculous. Right. I mean, they're obviously the boosters were again.
So this is a no. This is a no.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, just say no. Just say no. Listen, you're not a politician. Just say no. Just say no. So basically, what I'm trying to say is it's all built on house of cards. Everything was justified because, one, we've got a pandemic. There was not. Two, you instill fear and, you know, censorship. So any alternative treatment is shut down. And then to get people buying into the vaccine, you have to prove to them that there's a pandemic, charts showing people are dying left, right, and center. There is no other alternative treatment. Remember, the only way out of this pandemic is through the vaccine. We can only get our freedoms back through the vaccine. Now, you're a freedom fighter. I'm a freedom fighter. So we need to be clear about this, because these were the tactics being used. Make a fake pandemic, instill fear, have no other options, and then dangle the carrot that's a vaccine. Get people to buy into this experiment. And it was not informed consent. It was experimental. And it's still being pushed. Still is now on the children's schedule, which is criminal. And there's vaccine harms going on, more with this vaccine than with all other vaccines in the last 30 years. And I love all the stuff that you're pumping at about ULEZ and everything else. I want to hear more of this. Because
yeah, well, it's interesting because people,
this is the greatest medical scandal.
And you talk about it a lot, and I've had a lot of people on this show talk about it. And it's interesting that some people think I and Together and we don't talk about it. But just to remind everyone, we ran a campaign for a long time to challenge any children ever getting the vaccine. And then more recently, we worked in a collaboration with Perseus and Heart, UK Medical Freedom Alliance, to challenge the MHRA with the regulatory body to say, why is this happening? And there should be an immediate pause and stop on them. So I think some people get a little shrill and they get a bit on each part of this discussion. I suppose what I try and do on the show a bit more is to understand who and why and where. So I get that. Your analysis, and many people will agree with it, particularly people who have been challenging things for quite a long time. But what I'm also interested in is how, and I always use this example, if I try and convince people in my mum's street, not just of you, Les, but of anything else, about our democratic freedoms, about what informed consent is, about choice and those discussions, how one does it in a way that, you know, you can appeal to them and it has meaning. And I suppose one question that always comes up, and you say I'm not interested in the who's, but who is it that's doing these things with all these people agreeing to? Because it's tricky if one can't answer that.
Okay, well, I don't know the answers, but I mean, there's a lot of hints out there, you know. There's a lot of people who, you have to look about the money. You need to always follow the money. Follow the money. And who's profiting from all of this? And what is the money system that we've got? So we've got a fiat money system, which is a Ponzi scheme, which is collapsing. And any day now, it's just going to implode. And our Western leaders know this. And what I mean by that is money is fabricated from nothing, from debt. And that, you know, we're playing, you know, a game of time now where it's all going to fall apart. It's not sustainable. And we've got a demographic problem. People are living older. We've got pension liabilities in the billions, if not trillions. And the leaders know this, and they're running out of time. So what's going to happen? Well, we're not competing economically now with the BRICS nations and whatnot. So we're going to carry on with this Ponzi scheme. We're going to keep making money. And it's fundamentally a corrupt system. The big pharma, the military industrial complex, the wars in Ukraine, the vaccines that you're seeing, it's just fundamentally all corrupt. And they influence these big corporations, influence our politicians, they influence our media, they buy our media, they pay for the BBC and everybody else. And so they parrot out a narrative, a propaganda line. And much of it is, you know, lies covered in truth, which is then difficult for people to see through. But any real truth, real alternative is silenced and dissent and is not tolerated. So individuals who speak out of line or are a threat to the system are cancelled. And you just need to look at the WEF, the World Economic Forum. Now, I don't think they're the big boogeyman. I mean, they just might be the front. I mean, I don't know who the real actors are, but they say it. They talk about the Great Reset. What are you fighting? You're fighting ULEZ. What is that all about? The 15-minute cities, the restrictions and travel, carbon tax, you know, eating less meat. You know, all of this stuff is in their Great Reset.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing about intention. Ahmed, mm-hmm. 1 second. Here's the thing about the difference between, if you say this is what some people have intended, they've set this thing in motion, or if you say, how comes is it over the last 30 years when the public's been far less involved in politics and technocrats increasingly just talk to one another, they love to restrict, they love to impose measures because they're so separate from the public that all they know is control. They've got no ambitious ideas about how to deal with growth and development and prosperity as they might have done in the time of Butler or before. There are no Keynes or Hayek's or Adam Smith's anymore. There's just technocratic policy makers. And what they know, and they're internationally the case, this is internationally the case, they've got years, depending on institutions, you mentioned the WEF, the EU is a big one, the IMF is another big one, the UN with the WHO, all of these institutions that have been emptied out of meaning, and politicians have become reliant on those kind of meeting with those people, not being accountable to the public. But I'm not sure that's the same thing as just saying, you could say, you could split hairs, which is why I often say, you could think that, I could think this, but actually what we do about it here is important. Listen, we're going to carry this on. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Dr. Ahmed Malik. It's the next break. Please stay with us. This is TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In today's installment of White House Mystery Theater, we examine the case of the bouncing bump. Those paying attention over the holiday weekend here in America were surprised by the no-holds-barred, no-expense-spared, full-on hazmat response at no less an august address than 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Indeed, the White House was shut down from 17th to 18th Street and from Lafayette Park to the Ellipse, all because of a mysterious substance at first found in the library of the residence, which somehow, magically, perhaps via quantum mechanics, changed its location of discovery to a telephone cubby outside the visitor's entrance to the West Wing. Unfortunately, federal officials are apparently unaware of fingerprint technology because they say, due to the high traffic nature of the location where the item was discovered, there's no possible way to track it to any individual. The substance in question? Cocaine hydrochloride, the medical grade of cocaine, available only to doctors, dentists, and those with high-powered connections. Surely it's just a coincidence that Hunter appeared to be doing a bump behind Dr. Jill Biden on the Truman balcony over the holiday weekend. This, like all other Biden crime family mysteries, is destined to go unsolved, despite everyone knowing the truth. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Think tsunamis only happen somewhere else? Think again. Tsunamis happen when ocean water is displaced by an earthquake or other large undersea disturbance. Plan to act. If you are near the coast and feel a quake, hear the ocean roar, or see the water recede significantly, a tsunami may be approaching. Get moving. Go inland and up to safety. For more information, visit tsunami.gov.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Dr. Ahmed Malik, and we were just talking about what you really could you. I suppose my question is, what is the best thing to do about all these things, in your opinion, Ahmed? You know, these questions, yeah. These really big questions, right?
Great question. So basically, I fundamentally don't think the answer is what you've been doing, which is canvassing and putting pressure on politicians and trying to educate them and influence politicians. I've given up on politics in the sense that I think everyone should be involved in politics and listen to what's going on because politics affects all of our lives, but I've given up on politicians. I think all politicians, whether they're left or right, it's just a construct, it's a game. If you take the left and the extreme communism, take the right, extreme plutocracy and fascism, you know, eventually they both come around a big full circle and it's totalitarianism. It's just ways to control the masses. And I just don't like that. So I'm libertarian. Now, I remember reading an article of yours in Spiked where you said Ron Paul is no friend of freedom. And I was shocked by that because I love Ron Paul and he's a libertarian and he's a doctor and he stood up for freedom. And, you know, so, you know, I'm very much that libertarian, small government, small interference in our day-to-day life. Now, I think in the past, you remember the Communist Party. I don't know what your political leanings are. I'd love to hear where you stand in the political spectrum. But I think give up on, you know, politicians. They're all corrupt. They're all complicit. They're all confused. They're all dumb. They're all just narcissists. And, you know, they look at the bigger organizations for their funding, for their influence, for their policy decisions. They're puppets. They're absolute puppets. So as people, what we need to do is inform and educate ourselves, which knowledge is power. We need to be as independent as possible, break away from the system, shop locally, you know, have food cooperatives, get away from the supermarkets, buy locally, build your community, and grow your own food, connect with nature, get fit and healthy, use cash. And if you're fit and free, you know, that is the ultimate expression of freedom. You know, if you're sick and dependent, you know, you're in the system. So to fight back, knowledge, spread the knowledge so that next time people trying to instill fear in you and sell you a fake pandemic and fake vaccines, you turn around and say, no, that's what you do. So it's all about power of knowledge and stopping people from being dependent on others. I want to lift everyone up. I want to empower everyone. So that's where I stand. Oh, by the way, I really want to know, what are your political views now? Where do you stand on the politics?
So you've just said a load of things there, bit by bit. I actually consider myself to be a libertarian in many ways, but I don't agree with the idea. And I think there's a massive problem with trust having collapsed. And I think one of the reasons why some people are so beyond skeptical, but they just think that it's impossible to do anything where you bring people together and you have any kind of collective solution, is because they think that humans are basically mad, bad, and dangerous. You can't trust anything that any of them say. And somehow, just because independently one individual does something, somehow that makes it fine and brilliant. They might do all sorts of terrible things, as you said earlier on, right? Some people just do terrible things or are not very good. But there's this... So I would consider myself at the moment, if you really want to put a label on it, someone who's a libertarian, particularly in the idea of the state and our private lives and what we do and the decisions we make. But at the same time, we can utilize the state for big infrastructure projects, for investment in research and development, for building reservoirs. You know, you can grow your own little cabbage patch. But if you want to start building tunnels and engineering and having bridges and spaceships and any of those types of things. Now, some people may say they don't want it. Some people are very dystopian about technology. They think we've gone too far, the old romantic reaction to the Enlightenment. But I, you know, it's a bit like the discussion. It's a bit like, so I think that's where I would place myself. And there were very, you know, it's a lot that you've said just then. So there were very specific critiques. And I think that was the point I was making, about Ron Paul at the time, about his particular views on migration and actually abortion, which obviously are very controversial and they're important to be discussed and thought through. You know, for a libertarian to actually, really in many ways, I think, and I'm not just, oh, it's all relative. I've got very concrete views about many things in morality and in politics. But I also think that, you know, that libertarian is about freedom, particularly personal freedom. I think, Ahmed, that there's, even if people have different views, and what we try to do, and you slightly caricatured it together, because I think what you said is that, like, it's almost, if we only try to put pressure on councillors and MPs, NHS trusts and others, then that would be fair. But if we also, what we're doing at the same time, as I think you know, but it's the 360 approach. So what we say that we get the public and as many people locally, regionally and nationally, so regional ambassadors, local rallies, we do events around the country where we encourage people, friends, neighbours, family, colleagues, to get involved and stand out, many of which all disagree, like we have on our steering group, who we have very different views. And we attempt to, and it's very difficult because there are lots of independent minded people that think, well, maybe you should do it this way or that way. But we actually think that there are some principles around freedom and democracy. And you could say, oh, that's just the old way, all those Enlightenment ideals, liberty, freedom. But actually, it seems to be the same thing that you're arguing for. But I think there's an exhaustion with a sense of what's possible. And I actually do have quite an ambitious view about what we could do and turn things around in Britain. And I just think that the problem has been that the public has not come out and flex its muscles enough, and we need to get better, let's say fitter, at doing that. And it means we're going to have some difficult arguments and discussions. We aren't all going to agree. But if there are principles that we can agree around and we can encourage people to take a stake, not just write letters and email and call and go to MPs, which, by the way, now we're seeing everyone turn against you, Les, but actually get people to take a stand themselves. So we've supported people standing independently. We also support people organising locally in work groups and others, having events. We've just done one in Bristol a couple of days ago. We've got another one in Edinburgh on the 25th of July. We've got regular rallies and protests going on about ULEZ around London and outside, constantly encouraging people, whether a bit like the truckers in Canada or the farmers in the Netherlands, that sense of what we can all do. And that needs to be built. Yeah. And I'm not cynical about people in the sense that I think, oh, they're all going to be this. I think people can change. Some people may well be captured. I don't like that term. But I think generally, and this is the real point, that the human spirit and the human disposition can be many things, light and dark. But if you can appeal to reason and also to the spirit about what's best for, you know, us to be able to get for everyone. So go on, you have a thing. Asking loads of go for it. How would you see it?
So I really like a lot of what you just said there. And it's funny, I'm a child of the empire. So what does that mean? What is a brown kid named Ahmed Malik doing being born in Scotland? What's that all about? You know, I'm not a ginger. I'm not, you know, Angus Dalgleish or Scott McPherson. It's an Ahmed Malik from Glasgow. That's weird. So I'm a child of the empire. The British Empire went to India, the East India Company, and then the British Empire, the government took over. And, you know, Indians, millions of them, had enough of 300 years of rule from the British, and the British did not want to give it up. It was an amazing cash cow for them. How did they do it? Everybody knows about Gandhi. Everybody knows about that figure. And it was peaceful disobedience, non-compliance. Because the reality is these big monolithic organizations, corporations, governments don't want to relinquish power. It comes back to power. More than even money, people want power. And the reality is, I like what you're doing, trying to get the people and the public to get out on the streets to protest, because I think realistically, the only way the government will listen is to see feet on the ground, marches, people saying no and not taking part. Because the reality is, they only get their power from us giving them our sovereign power. And the moment we realize that we shouldn't do that, we don't give our power away, that's how we then get our way. Now, fundamentally, being a libertarian, my philosophy is, and my belief, that governments only grow bigger and bigger. They might start off with good intentions, like you said, build spaceships and tunnels and whatnot, but they are a self-serving organism. They just grow and grow like a cancerous growth, and they just sap more. Not, and this is not malign. I'm not saying beginning. It's just, but that's just the way it goes. They need to justify themselves, their purpose. They keep rewarding themselves. They keep getting bigger budgets and more control on over our daily lives. Now, you talked about building tunnels. Take HS2. This is a tunnel, high-speed trains that literally shave off 10, 15, 20 minutes in the journey. Who cares? No one wants that. It's tearing up our countryside. It's costing us over 150 billion or whatever pounds. No one wants it. We've had protests. We've had marches. We've had demonstrations. No one's listening. The government's not listening. They don't care. They're not listening to us. And who does it help? It helps the big corporations. It's helping their cronies who fund their parties. And this is the thing that happens. The governments just end up serving few individuals and corporations, money, corruption. They resign from their political position. And guess what? They're on the board of directors of a company. It happens again and again and again. It's fundamentally corrupt. So what we need is, we need to radically change the way our political system operates in this country. We don't need 650 MPs. At most, we need 100. We need an elected upper house. We need politicians not to have a revolving door where they go into politics and then into a corporation. You know, no, forget that. That can't happen. And, you know, we need to be able to hold them to account. We need to be able to take them away from their position. If they're not doing what they're meant to be doing, which is representing the people, we need to be able to vote them out. Nope, you're not doing our job. Why are you listening to Klaus Schwab? You should be listening to us. Why are you listening to Bill Gates? Why are you pushing these vaccines? I mean, look at Bill Gates. People forget that he invested in the vaccine companies and did a massive profit and sold his shares, having made hundreds of millions of pounds. You know, where's the conflict of interest there? Why is no one talking about that? Well, guess what? He's paid a few million pounds to the media outlets to make sure, and fact checkers, so no one's able to question. And this is the corruption that we're looking at. It's just corrupt. So people need to stop playing the game and need to learn to say the word no. N-O. Over to you, Alan. Alan's gone. I think I'm going to be the host of the TNT radio now.